Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. It's T-minus 5 days, people. Not much time for those celebrating Christmas to rush to the mall, prowl online retailers, and frantically wrap gifts in a tornado of wrapping paper and bows that will be used exactly once.
I'm actually 2 seconds away from an anxiety attack, but it's okay. We'll make it through for the holidays.
Well, that's what one shopper told ABC7 in San Francisco last year. But what if you just didn't? What if you just walked away from the stress, the debt, and the materialism? What if you tried a no-gift Christmas? What would that be like? I mean, how would it work? Would it be fun? Or would your kids shoot you the stink eye for months to come? Some families are trying it, and this hour we're going to hear their stories. This hour on Point, celebrating a no-gift Christmas. And you can join us. Would you do a no-gift Christmas? Are you? Does your family hold alternative traditions to gift-giving? Or is there something about being able to show your love and care through a gift that's still important and meaningful to your Christmas? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Now, a little later this hour, we'll talk about the New York Times story about Democratic efforts to use social media to influence the 2017 Alabama Senate special election. That's much later this hour. But first, let's get this conversation about a no-gift Christmas going. Joining us via Skype from San Carlos, California, is Joe Pinsker, staff writer at The Atlantic. He covers families, parenting, and education. And we have a link to his recent story headlined, The Joy of a No-Gift Christmas. That link is at onpointradio.org. Joe, welcome to the program.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. First of all, let me ask you, how hard was it to find people to talk to about no-gift Christmases? Because Americans spend, what, more than $670 billion at the holidays. So was it a needle in a haystack?
It was a little bit of a needle in a haystack, but people started showing themselves online. I actually had a lot of luck looking around places like Reddit and other people's blog posts, because the people who do this and establish alternative traditions and opt out of Christmas gift giving, some of them like to talk about it, and they have a story to tell. And so I was able to find a good handful of people through those means by reaching out to them.
Okay, so tell us some of their stories. Who did you talk to, and why did they say that they were at least trying to have a Christmas without presents under the tree?
Absolutely. So I talked to all sorts of people. I talked to people with young kids. I talked to people without kids. I talked to older people. And it's, you can't really say that there was a single reason that all of them stopped doing it. But I think the underlying thing that I found united all of them was that a lot of them just wanted to spend more time with each other and less time figuring out what to get someone, less money on those gifts. And basically, I think I talked to a family who lives in the San Francisco Bay Area, flies to West Texas every year for the holidays, and they established a kind of re-gifting tradition that was a little bit different. But then I also talked to other people who gave up gifts entirely. Some people dropped gifts and then donated their entire gift budget to charity. There were all sorts of different reasons.
Right. And so let's sort of take apart some of these first. I mean, we, in the introduction to this hour, we played that tape from a San Francisco shopper last year saying that she was 2 seconds away from an anxiety attack. I actually think a lot of people feel that way because there's a lot of pressure, right? Getting the right gift, getting it on time, hopefully not spending too much on it. The number of gifts that you have to get. I mean, I'm feeling a little anxious just even describing the pressure that folks are under.
Absolutely. I mean, I think people are, I definitely detected a lot of exhaustion in all the people that I talked to. I think people were, they started looking at almost breaking down. I could hear them as I was talking to them think about the number of hours it would take to shop, the number of hours it would take to wrap, the number of hours it would take to sort of be secretive and make sure that this gift stays in the closet or something. And then there was this one family I was talking to. It was this family that I mentioned that celebrates the holidays in West Texas. They're the Hund family. And they – I just heard the mother talking about how much fun they were having because they weren't doing all this stuff. They were playing cards with each other. They were cooking together. They were doing all these things that, and I was, it kind of made me think, wow, what am I doing with those hours of my time come Christmas time?
But you know, to the point you were making earlier about the family in Texas who sort of agreed to do this, it has to be a family agreement, right? I mean, because, yeah, you know, what if there are members of your family who the act of giving a gift is important? It's, you know, a point of pride. Say, like, this is how I communicate my love for you, and I thought about you and what your year has been like and maybe what you need. Like, it's part of the tradition of the holiday.
Yes, it definitely is. It takes a bit of negotiating. It takes a bit of diplomacy, as any big family tradition change would. I did find when I was talking to people that the younger generations typically were more open to change, and it was the older ones that were a little bit more stubborn sometimes. And for the most part, people were, you know, okay. Their relatives were okay with the change. Some of the friction that people ran into often came from like the matriarch or the patriarch of the family, this grandma or something, who really had been doing this for a long time, communicated their love through gifts, and just could not for the life of them understand why someone would opt out of this really beloved tradition.
Yeah.
But even then, a lot of people came around to that.
Right.
So,
well, you know what? I want to get to callers here this hour because I just want to hear from people who are trying this out or maybe don't like the idea at all. We are talking about experimenting with or maybe even fully engaging with a no-gift Christmas and what that would look like and why, what the reasons are behind eschewing the materialism of a modern day Christmas. You know, by the way, Joe, I've seen some numbers that say Americans spend more than on average $900 this season, I think, per person on gift giving. And we should just acknowledge that there are a lot of Americans out there who cannot even spend that much. So maybe no gift giving isn't an option for them, right? That they don't even have the money to make ends meet. So gift giving is beyond what they can afford. And I want to touch on that in a little bit. But let's go to Anna, who's calling from Lakeland, Florida. Anna, you're on the air.
Hey, how are you? Happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
Feliz Navidad. I just wanted to mention what we do. We used to spend a lot of money, let's put it this way. But now our son is grown. He's 25. And what we do is on Thanksgiving, we make suggestions as to what we should do as to what kind of gift giving. And we set standards, you know, like we put it in a bowl and then the oldest of the clan and the youngest of the clan will select and then we vote on the suggestion. One year we just went to see the Star Wars movie and the whole clan went and we went to dinner. That was our Christmas gift to each other. This year we selected a $15 gift card for each other. And that's basically and we all come in accordance with that.
Yeah. So Anna, you put a cap on the gift card. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but you put a cap on the price of the gift card, and because it's a gift card, people can get whatever they want.
Exactly. And you won't go through the rush of running around trying to figure out, does this fit him? Does this look good on him? Do you think he's going to like it? What about her? She must have the same thing. I don't know what to do. And that anxiety goes away. And you get to enjoy time with your family and have your coconut nog, because us Puerto Ricans do coquito instead of eggnog. And we have our roast pork and family gathering. And we love it.
It's
much simpler for each other.
Oh, well, Anna, first of all, when I say goodbye to you, don't hang up. Give us the recipe for that coconut nog. That sounds amazing. Thank you so much for your call, Anna. Joe Pinsker, hang on here for just a second because I want to bring in another voice into this conversation. Guinevere Higgins joins us now. She's with us from Charlottesville, Virginia. She's Director of Strategic Partnerships for New Dream, a nonprofit that's dedicated to rethinking consumption. And for 13 years, New Dream's, quote, Simplify the Holidays campaign has advocated for holidays with less stuff. Guinevere Higgins, welcome to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, you know, I keep thinking about, you know, the vast amounts of money that Americans do spend during the holidays. And is it fair, though, to say that is there a growing trend of no gift giving or alternative traditions, or is this still sort of an underground thing?
You know, it's really interesting. I think, you know, what we hear from folks who utilize the resources in our campaign year in and year out is that they feel so grateful that there are other people like them who have opted to rethink how they do Christmas. And, you know, that's such a powerful thing to feel like you're part of something larger because, you know, the whole Christmas consumerism thing is so prevalent. It's like it's in the air we breathe. So, you know, feeling like there are others out there, people really love hearing stories. And I loved Anna's story about what they've done differently and how much more meaningful it is for them and how they've also focused on what really matters to their family. I mean, what matters more than delicious food? Mm. And that's a great way to, you know, to really build your Christmas and holiday traditions.
Okay, so it may be one thing for an adult to say, you know what, I'm going to push back against the materialism and consumerism that has definitely crept into celebrations of Christmas. I mean, Thanksgiving has been virtually obliterated because the Christmas buying season starts so early now. But, you know, it is still so much part of the culture. We just got 30 seconds before we have to take a quick break here. But how do you approach that with, say, your younger kids?
Absolutely. And I have a four-year-old. I get it. So I think it's important to have the conversations early, really set the expectations. If you do have young children, it's really important to have those conversations with the grandparents. And New Dream has incredible resources, videos, talking points, all kinds of resources available for folks who want to think about how to have those conversations.
Well, we're going to just take a quick break here and pick up this conversation when we come back. Guinevere Higgins is with us. She's Director of Strategic Partnerships for New Dream. And Joe Pinsker is also with us. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic who's written about the joy of a no-gift Christmas. Are you doing a no-gift Christmas, or does the idea sound absolutely crazy to you? I'm going to go out here with a classic, You're a Mean One, Mr. Grinch. This is On Point.
You nauseate me, Mr. Grinch, with a nauseous super nos. You're a crooked, jerky jockey, and you drive a crooked hoss. Mr. Grinch, you're a three-decker sauerkraut and toadstool sandwich with arsenic sauce.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about no-gift Christmases and the potential joy that's to be had from stepping back from the obligation of spending a lot of money and time and anxiety to give gifts to your loved ones this holiday season. We're joined by Joe Pinsker. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic. He's written about this, and we have a link to his story at onpointradio.org. Guinevere Higgins is also with us. She's Director of Strategic Partnerships for New Dream, a nonprofit that's dedicating to rethinking consumption. And Joe and Guinevere, we've got a lot of comments coming in online here. Jenny Mummert says, simplified Christmas years ago, disgusted with commercialism. Now, each grandchild gets three $20 bills, one to spend, one to save, and one to donate. Oh, Jenny, what a fantastic idea. Ben West says, too much emphasis on gift buying can be bad, yet at the same time, all the buying does produce jobs. Totally giving up on gift buying is certain to have something of a negative effect on the economy. Joe Pinsker, respond to that. What do you think about what Ben says?
I think it's a, I suppose it's a good point. I haven't worked out all the economics of all this, but I do think that it is possible also to revisit gifting traditions and maybe scale it back a little. Some of the people I was talking to, they weren't saying that they were going to just stop buying things entirely. They were also just thinking a lot more mindfully about what it was they were going to buy. Everything they looked into buying, they were saying, how does this affect the environment? Mm-hmm. Was this made under conditions that were fair to the workers? Things like that. And so I think there are maybe ways to revisit spending without triggering a whole economic downfall.
Yeah. So Guinevere Higgins, then pick up on that thought. I mean, how would you suggest that families go about sort of thinking about revisiting spending and in exchange also sort of crafting new traditions instead?
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole suite of options available to you, you know, that run the gamut from the, you know, excessive material, you know, stressful Christmas all the way to the no gifts. And we have a ton of incredible gift ideas that involve oftentimes not even buying anything. They're great for, you know, last minute gift ideas if you like to put off your gifts, but you're starting to rethink that. Coupon books and that kind of thing, gifts of skill and time are great. You don't even have to spend any money. But I think, you know, I love Jenny's idea about the share, save, spend. Mm-hmm. Not only is that, you know, reducing your own, your own stress around Christmas and gifts, but it's also teaching young children about how to be, you know, good stewards of their finances. So that's a beautiful thing. I know, you know, we talk a lot about the idea of doing a donation exchange. So rather than buying a material gift for your loved ones, you know, get them a gift of a charitable donation in your loved one's name. Yeah. For a cause they care about.
Well, Joe, though, I mean, in your story, I remember reading that you also have to, if you're going to embrace this new tradition of not giving gifts or giving alternative gifts, for example, that are more environmentally minded, you also have to brace yourself for some perhaps shade from people who are receiving the gifts, right? Because you yes. talked to someone who, like, she's just very environmentally minded. And she was, her gift to her friends and family was like LED light bulbs. Mm-hmm. And she said, not everyone wants those gifts.
Yes. It wasn't just LED light bulbs. It was LED light bulbs with a little note that had a bad pun, like, have a bright year. So I think there were some people who were not thrilled to be receiving that. But I think that this kind of speaks to a larger point that fascinated me about all the different people I heard from. I mean, yeah, this woman met a bit of resistance when she gave these gifts. Some people received it really well. But in general, this is the way that this woman, Kia Chatterjee in DC, this is the way she's thinking about consumption all year round. And Christmas is this time where everyone's thoughts about money and things and materialism, they all converge. It's all heightened. Everybody's thinking so much more about all this than they usually are. But it's also things that they're thinking about all year long anyway. And it seems like it just sort of concentrates right now.
Yeah. Well, you know what?
Absolutely.
No surprise here. There's a lot of folks who want to who join this conversation through the phone line. So let me turn to them. Andrea is calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Andrea, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. Are you doing a no-gift Christmas this year?
We are. We started last year, and it worked. And thankfully, our son is young enough to not have really understood consumerism yet. So that's just going to be his normal, hopefully.
Oh, that's terrific. And so what do you do instead?
Well, I'm a vet. My husband is active duty. Both of us have deployed to places where kids have nothing.
Yeah.
Mm. And it broke our heart to see how different it is. You know, kids here are expecting hundreds of dollars worth of gifts and, you know, feeling very sad when they don't get it. But there are other kids who they're just hungry. Mm-hmm. You know, they're tired of war. And so what we do is we go into our community on Christmas Eve and Christmas to a shelter, to anywhere we can go to give to those who are less fortunate in our own communities.
Yeah.
And we bring our son.
Yeah.
And hope that he sees the value in giving to others rather than just thinking about what he wants to give himself.
Right. Andrea, thank you so very much for your call, and happy holidays to you. Guinevere, Andrea brings up an excellent point. I mean, obviously, in many places abroad, but even here, I mean, yeah. We should think about, especially here, there are many families and children who have next to nothing at all. And yet there are still many others of us who are fortunate enough to be able to even have this option of, should we buy gifts or not? And I think that this is on the minds of a lot of parents, especially, to how to push back against materialism and consumer culture that, through no fault of their own, their children are just immersed in. All the time. I mean, I really hear that in Andrea's story. I think it's something that probably touches a nerve with a lot of folks.
Absolutely. I totally agree. And, you know, I think we have to remind ourselves it's an incredible privilege, you know, to be able to make the choice to do a no-gift Christmas or an alternative Christmas gifting tradition. You know, and you know, this issue is different for different people. I mean, for folks who are, you know, who have financial challenges, it can actually be a real important source of pride and dignity to be able to provide for your children mm-hmm. at Christmas. So we have to tread carefully. But I think, you know, there's some amazing statistic, like 45% of Americans would prefer to skip Christmas entirely because of the financial pressure.
Yeah.
You know, and that affects people at every income level. So, you know, if 45% of Americans, and that's a data point from 2012, but I imagine it's still largely true, you know, if they want to just skip it, let's take the opportunity to rethink it. And I think, you know, what we oftentimes hear from folks who utilize our resources around simplifying their holidays is that, you know, they wish they could just take a magic wand and change the culture, because that's the real sticking point. You know, you can maybe make your changes within your own family, but, you know, your kids hear about stuff at school. Certainly the advertising is just rampant. And as so many people have said, you know, it kicks off before Halloween.
Oh, yeah. Well, Joe, I mean, Joe, but about that point of changing the culture, I mean, you talked to some folks in your story who, you know, who are concerned about the celebration of Christmas drifting away from the religious meaning that they desire and they find in it, that you know, for Christians celebrating Christmas. You talk to folks who say it's become more about the gifts than the lessons that they're learning in church, for example.
Right. Yes, this is definitely a big segment of people who are opting out of gift giving entirely. And this is also not new. This is, you know, something that Christians and have been saying for a long, long time. I just happened to talk to a family who was really distraught that materialism and consumerism had just totally overridden all these underlying concerns. This particular family was Catholic, and they were talking about how Advent, which is the season leading up to Christmas, is supposed to be this calm, meditative, relaxing time where you reflect on your year. And they were just so upset and also even just confused and exasperated that this had been just totally invaded by calls to buy stuff. And so they were trying to reclaim it in a lot of ways.
Well, let's go to Tushar, who's calling from San Antonio, Texas. Tushar, you're on the air.
Hello, Meghna, and hello to your panel. I trust you all had a great week so far. I just really have one point that's really, you know, comes down to with the real wage stagnation that we've been seeing over the last few decades and the current culture of hyper-consumerism. We're seeing a development in culture of exclusion by developing in and out groups of people with expensive gifts and without. And going to a no-gift Christmas would do a lot to mitigate that culture of exclusion that's being created.
Right. Tushar, thank you so much for your call. And in addition, there's pressures for people who perhaps can't necessarily afford the gifts they'd like to give. There's pressure on them to go into debt in order to have what they believe to be a satisfactory Christmas. Let's go to Shauna, who's calling from Port Washington, Ohio. Shauna, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Are you doing a no-gift Christmas this year?
I am not. I would love to because I don't like clutter and I don't like things. However, I recognize that I have a lot of people in my life who their love language is giving gifts and receiving gifts. So with that being said, one of the things that we did when I was growing up was to actually make each other gifts each year. So what that actually ended up doing was teaching us as kids valuable skills. Well, I don't know if they're valuable, but different skills like sewing and wood carving and things like that. And in return, you got some really cool handmade gifts from your siblings and from your parents.
Yeah. Shauna, thank you so much for your call. I love the point that Shauna's making. And Guinevere, let me turn back to you. Shauna talked about how a lot of her family's love, the language of that love is through giving and just finding alternative ways, you know, even if it's still giving a gift to accomplish that, but perhaps by spending less.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of giving a gift to someone you love, it's a beautiful thing, right? But I think it is important, as Joe mentioned earlier, you know, people are starting to really think through, you know, does this gift-giving practice align with my values, you know, around the environment, around, you know, my own financial stability, you know, around how workers are treated and, you know, folks pulling 12-hour shifts in Amazon warehouses so that we can order gifts on Christmas Eve and have them the next day. It's shocking the number of retailers that are open Christmas Eve and Christmas Day now. You know, I picked up my car from the car dealership yesterday for a recall, and the guy at the desk told me, you know, they've got to work Christmas Eve a full day. You know, and so really thinking about, you know, how do our traditions align with our values? I think Shauna's story is beautiful. You know, her family values, you know, gifts that are made with love, you know, from scratch. That's a beautiful thing.
Let's go to Elizabeth, who's calling from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Elizabeth, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I love this conversation, and my family has always done a Secret Santa, my extended family. And so for a couple of those years, what we did was drew names and then checked out a library book for each other and wrapped it up and gave it to each other just as if it were a normal present. We had a chance to read the books, discuss them, and then return them to the library. And we do live in different parts of the state, but Iowa has an open access policy, so no matter what library you return it to in the state, they'll mail it back to the home library.
Oh, wow, great. Great. Well, Elizabeth, thank you so much for your call. Joe Pinsker, did you talk to anyone else in the process of writing your story who had ideas like Elizabeth's about checking library books out for each other?
I actually did happen to. That was the same environmental advocate that I was talking about earlier. She would, in her words, lovingly check out a library book for somebody, maybe browse the aisles and think deeply about what they might want to read, and then put a little note in about why they'd enjoy it. And I thought that was a nice solution to not buying something and not creating more stuff in the world. At the same time, I feel like maybe some people wouldn't have been pleased to have the obligation of returning a library book, but I do think it's a creative way to address this.
Yeah. Well, let's go to Kent, who's calling from Lexington, Virginia. Kent, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Doing very well. What about you? Are you going to celebrate a no-gift Christmas?
I'm trying anyway. I've been carrying on a campaign to eliminate gift-triggering events for about 45 years. That's birthdays, anniversaries, Christmas, any of those standard gift-triggering events. I'm known as sort of a Scrooge in my family, but my wife sort of compensates for it by her largesse. But in fact, my theory is that anything that we want or need, we already have.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
by definition, if people are spending their time and money to buy a present for me, they're buying something that I don't really want, because if I wanted it, I already have it.
Mm.
I do give gifts throughout the year. When I see something someone would like, I buy it for them and I give it to them immediately.
Yeah.
And I like to be there when they receive the gift and enjoy it with them.
Yeah. Well, Kent, thank you so much for your call. Guinevere, one thing that Kent's making me think of, though, is we still have to also acknowledge perhaps there are situations in which a person or a family wants something or needs something. I should say not perhaps, but certainly there are situations like that where, you know, someone giving them the gift of that thing is actually helpful because they couldn't afford it themselves.
Sure. I mean, you know, again, there are many options. You know, a lot of people, you don't have to go cold turkey. You know, there's a lot you can do just to think through, you know, what works for our family? You know, what matters to us? I mean, that's what New Dream really focuses on is, you know, it's more of what matters and less of what doesn't. Because the stuff that doesn't matter, it burdens us, it stresses us out, it wastes money, and it hurts the environment.
Mm.
So if you can be thinking through, you know, with that frame. I also want to pick up on something that Kent mentioned. Which is something we've been thinking a lot about, which is that, you know, a lot of the issues around holiday gifting and holiday stress, they're gendered. They fall predominantly to women. I'd kind of like to talk to Kent's wife and see what she thinks about, you know, her having to make up. I think it's wonderful what his message is. But this is an issue primarily that falls to women and mothers. And let's talk about that. Let's ask them what they want and what would make their holidays more enjoyable.
I'm pretty sure right now in cars and kitchens and wherever, homes across America, you're hearing a chorus of amens, Guinevere.
And I'm speaking for myself as well, you know, and I had a conversation with one of my son's preschool teachers around, she feels this need to make the perfect Christmas for her children. And that's, you know, that takes a lot of work.
Yeah. Well, we are talking about the potential joy of a no-gift Christmas, or maybe an alternative gift Christmas for folks who want to push back against consumerism, maybe not go into debt or feel the anxiety that's cropped up around the modern Christmas holiday. Guinevere Higgins is with us. She's director of strategic partnerships for New Dream. And Joe Pinsker is also with us. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic. Let's let Eartha Kitt talk to us a little bit, or sing to us a little bit, about a 1953 Christmas. This is Eartha Kitt's Santa Baby. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
I really do believe in you. Let's see if you believe in me.
Boom, 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 boom.
Santa baby, forgot to mention one little thing, a ring. I don't mean on the phone, Santa baby, so hurry down the chimney tonight. Hurry down the chimney tonight. Hurry tonight.
Three decades ago, Sterling Cunha was an angry, violent teenager facing life without parole. Today, he's a celebrated author and a peacemaker. His journey is a window into how violence is perpetuated in this country. But it's also a story about how people change.
There's no better example of a person who's prepared to be released.
And about people changing the system.
We have to reimagine what we're doing, because what we're doing isn't working.
This is Cell Blocks to Mountaintops, a podcast and video series. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about a no-gift Christmas and why people are doing it and why maybe you are too. Joe Pinsker joins us today, and so does Guinevere Higgins. And Guinevere, I'm going to get to a bunch more callers because, the phones are ringing. But I did want to ask you a question about social pressures around giving, specifically about kids, right? Because, you know, this is something that that families who don't have a lot of money to begin with have to face every year. And again, I want to repeatedly acknowledge that. But in addition, for those families who say they want to move away from gift giving or come up with alternative traditions, I mean, when I was growing up, something I'd always dread was coming back to school after Christmas, because kids, you know, compare the gifts that they got. Maybe they're wearing fancy new sneakers or talking about their latest video game console. And then you're just kind of standing there saying, I've got a library book. And I don't mean to make light of it, because, I mean, these are the social pressures that give rise to consumerism. So, I mean, how to combat that?
Absolutely. It's such an important issue. And, you know, again, this is so part of our culture. And that's why I think it's important to be having these conversations and to be changing the social norms around how we do Christmas. You know, if we can do it at Christmas, we can do it in other areas of our lives. And I think that's, you know, it's real. And I have similar memories. I talked to a friend who said, yeah, I remember crying at Christmas, feeling like I didn't get everything I wanted. I mean, that's a terrible thing. What are we doing to our kids? You know, I'll also mention that, you know, this is such an important issue at Christmas, but also beyond Christmas, because we know that kids are marketed to in really insidious ways.
Relentlessly, yeah.
Relentlessly, in ways that even grown-ups don't fully understand. There's actually a complaint in right now to the FTC about Google that New Dream's a signatory to. It's being pushed by our wonderful partners at the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood around the ads that are embedded in so-called educational apps for kids. And they're getting advertised to. And it's deeply, it's something the parents don't fully understand. And it's something, these apps and toys, internet-connected toys, they're really putting our children's privacy at risk, and they're exposing our children to unbelievable advertising that they don't understand. Children under the age of 8 and even older, cognitively, they cannot understand the difference between advertising and program content.
Right. They think it's part of the show. Exactly.
Absolutely. Yeah. So they're ripe for that kind of manipulation. And then, of course, what do? They go to their parents and they say, I want the, insert your favorite cartoon character. I want the pajamas. I want the lunchbox. I want all this stuff. Yeah. So really limiting children's screen time and really being aware of the kinds of media that they're consuming is incredibly important, not just at Christmas, but all throughout the year.
And I'd also emphasize, in addition to that, that, to sort of try and create a culture, family culture, school culture, where there's no shame around no gifts as
well. Absolutely.
Before we run out of time, I want to get some more folks in here. So let's go to Jennifer, who's calling from Lawrence, Massachusetts. Jennifer, you're on the air.
Hi. Hi. Can you hear me?
We can, but it's a bit tough. So
hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah,
can you hear me now?
Go ahead. We don't have too much time, Jennifer, so go ahead.
Yeah, I want to go back to this conversation about no giving versus conscious giving, because Christmas is one of the most important, whether we want to admit it or not, and I know both of your guests know this, it's an important time of indicating the markets and how job growth is going, declines, all these things. We have a huge sense of power as consumers to purchase things that are improving people's lives versus making the world a crappy place, right?
Right.
So if you look at companies that have, even with the whole thing about advertising on kids' apps, if you look at companies that are paying people minimum wages, have great health insurance, doing profit sharing, conscious of environmentalism, if we as a country were to look at that as a massive way of changing culture, and I know that the New Dream does this, but if we were sending that message, not no purchasing or making, stuff, homemade stuff is wonderful, it's lovely, it's very endearing, but people's jobs are at stake. So, you talk about people who don't have money to make this choice. It's because we have shopped ourselves right out of a viable economy by purchasing things that are so low wage and disposable. It's this fast industry.
Yeah. So Jennifer, I'm going to just jump in here, and forgive me for cutting you off. It's just that I want to be sure to get our guests a chance to respond to you. But I really appreciate your call and the point you're making. Joe Pinsker, respond to Jennifer saying that, she's saying there's an opportunity here for really focusing on conscious gifting or conscious consumerism around the holiday times.
I absolutely agree with her that this is totally an opportunity to do that. And as I was saying earlier, I think Christmas is this time when our minds are so on what we buy and how we think about what we're buying that it represents a really good opportunity to revisit all the ways that we spend the rest of the year. I definitely have talked to people who would never give up their gifting tradition and don't want to, take people's jobs away at all. But what they're doing instead is thinking about how they allocate that money. I mean, what if instead of, hundreds of billions of dollars are spent every year on Christmas gifts, and what if that money still was spent, but just went towards things that were better made, were made by people who were treated fairly, if it was spent on things that didn't harm the environment as much. There are all sorts of ways that we could reallocate instead of just unplugging entirely.
Yeah. Guinevere Higgins, what's your thought?
I completely agree with Joe, and I would just put in a plug as someone who's a professional fundraiser, if you could convert some of those dollars that go towards, buying stuff and convert them into charitable donations, that would make an enormous, enormous impact. And show your loved ones that you care, in a way that aligns with your values.
Let's see if I can sneak in another call here. Beth is calling from Natick, Massachusetts. Beth, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. I am the education director for an Episcopal church, so I realize that I'm coming at this from a particularly faith-focused, you know, point of view. But we have extended the season of Advent, and I know a number of churches are doing this from 4 weeks to 7 weeks. This is our third year doing it. And we've actually physically converted our church. It's we've turned it blue lights, blue fabric. It's really trying to get back to the idea of Advent as a time of preparation, as quiet. One of your guests had mentioned this before, and really allowing even the youngest children. I teach the preschoolers and kindergartners to have a space apart, you know, even if it's an hour and a half a week from the consumerism, and really refocus. And I'm not naive. I understand that they're going to, you know, go out there in the world and be sort of consumer crazed the rest of the time. But we really try to focus, and it's amazing the feedback that I hear from even the littlest kids. If I say, okay, let's talk about what gift are we getting, and they say, we're getting the gift of Jesus. And I know that that's not, you know, the case for everybody. Not everybody comes at it with such a faith focus.
But they appreciate
it. We really underestimate
it.
Our kids.
Yeah. Well, Beth, thank you so much for your call. You know, we could go on and on, but we're flat out of time here. I just wanted to ask you, Joe, one last question before we wrap up this conversation. After all of this and your reporting, are you doing a no-gift Christmas this year?
It's a great question. I am actually doing a gift Christmas this year, as I have for all the previous years that I've been alive. But I must say that in the course of reporting this story, as I was talking to people over the course of a couple weeks, it also happened to be the same couple weeks when I was shopping online for my family, when I was going to stores, when I was thinking about all this stuff. I was kind of adding up all the time and energy in my head.
Yeah.
And it just made me really think deeply about what I'll be doing next year.
Wow.
So ask me in a year.
Well, Joe Pinsker, staff writer at The Atlantic, thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
And Guinevere Higgins, director of strategic partnerships for New Dream, a nonprofit dedicated to rethinking consumption. Pleasure to speak with you, Guinevere. Thank you so very
much.
Likewise.
Thank you, Magna.
We're going to switch gears here in a moment, but I wanted to close this conversation with my favorite Christmas song. It's a little sappy, but it's my favorite. Little Drummer Boy, because it's a song about the joy of giving your time, your talent, and your love, and the absolute wonder of an infant's smile. I cry every time I hear this song. We'll be back in a moment. This is On Point. That song. Okay, well, let's switch gears here because we've got a follow-up to a story we brought to you yesterday. Yesterday, we talked about a pair of major reports presented to the Senate Intelligence Committee about Russia's attempts to influence African-American voters through social media. We spoke with Renee DiResta. She's director of research at the firm New Knowledge that authored one of those reports.
On a multi-year influence operation, it wasn't necessarily focused on the political, though that was, of course, a part of it. They created a number of pages, 88, I think, on Facebook and 133 on Instagram, and those were segmented across various facets of U.S. society, including Facebook, I believe, 30 pages targeting the African-American community.
That was DiResta on our program yesterday. Well, last night, after our show was broadcast, the New York Times published a story reporting that the firm New Knowledge was part of a group of Democratic tech experts who tried to use similarly deceptive social media tactics in the 2017 Alabama Senate special election. Now, DiResta did not work for the company at the time, but The Times reports that she has a small role to play in this story. Now, we reached out to Renee DiResta and have not heard back from her, but joining us now with more is Scott Shane. He reported or co-reported the story for the New York Times. We have a link at onpointradio.org. He joins us from Baltimore. Scott, welcome to the program.
Hi, Meghna.
Okay, so first of all, tell us a little bit more about what you reported about what this group of Democratic operatives attempted to do in the Alabama special election using social media techniques. What did they try to do?
Well, I have to say that the people who did this were not eager to talk about it. And so I'm not sure we have every detail, but essentially they deliberately experimented with what you might call the Russian techniques on social media. One of the things they did was they created a conservative page, though they were not conservatives, oriented to or designed to attract conservatives in Alabama. And they used that, among other things, to try to split the Republican electorate. They also used it to communicate with a write-in candidate whose candidacy they supported with the idea of drawing votes away from the Republican Roy Moore and sort of draining votes from him. And that was, you know, certainly a fraudulent move in the sense that they were posing as conservatives and they weren't mm-hmm. conservatives. And then something that remains a little murkier, but they, in a report that I obtained about this operation, they describe it as an elaborate false flag operation that planted the idea that the Moore campaign was amplified on social media by a Russian botnet. Essentially, there were a bunch of stories in the mainstream press saying, geez, there's all these Russians who are following Roy Moore on Twitter. And, you know, it was sort of an embarrassment for the Moore campaign, and they said maybe it was a dirty trick, and no one really knew what where this came from. And we don't know exactly what was done, whether these operators actually purchased, as one can do, essentially bought Twitter accounts and, you know, sent them after Roy Moore. Uh-huh. Or how exactly it worked. But in any case, they seem to have done something to try to discredit the Moore campaign on Twitter.
Okay. So now, to be clear, one, as you're reporting, one of the participants in this, what, $100,000 Democratic operation was Jonathan Morgan, the chief executive of New Knowledge. And okay, and just to remind folks again, New Knowledge is the firm that wrote one of these reports that was just submitted to the Senate Intelligence Committee about Russian interference or Russian use of social media. So, but let me ask you, I mean, the reason why we definitely wanted to talk to you today is, as I mentioned at the beginning, we spoke with Renee D'Arresta, who's with New Knowledge now, and you talked to her as well, even though she didn't work for the company at the time in 2017. What role does she have to play in this story?
Yeah, well, let me make a couple things clear. One thing is, as far as we can tell, the Democratic campaign, Doug Jones' campaign, knew nothing about this and had no role in it, and literally learned about it in the last couple of days when we started calling them. So they had nothing to do with it. And according to Jonathan Morgan, the CEO of New Knowledge, as you point out, New Knowledge as a company had nothing to do with it. This was sort of a side project that he participated in. And early on, he asked Renee D'Arresta essentially for advice on this. And according to both of them, he called her up and said, hey, we want to sort of do an experiment where we test out some of these sort of Russian-style techniques and try to understand them better. What are some of the things we could do? What are some of the things you can do on social media that we might sort of do and test? And he describes this as sort of an academic exercise. And she claims that she was not paid for it and really was just sort of a very early consultant in this process.
Yeah. Well, and you quote her as saying that there were people who believed the Democrats needed to fight fire with fire and that she disagreed with that. Scott, we have like 30 seconds here to go. I just want one last thing. I mean, so this is quite an eye-opening piece of reporting from you. It is a little jarring to hear some of these Democrats say this is like an academic exercise, but it was done in the context of a real-life special election, a hotly contested one at that.
Absolutely, and one with a very a close finish. And the report, unlike the people we interviewed, the report, the written report on this project, essentially brags about having an influence on the voters. I think the real significance here is that these techniques are out there. People know about them from what the Russians did in 2016. And there are people in both the Republican and Democratic Party who are, on the one hand, intrigued about this stuff, and on the other hand, terrified that this is going to become a sort of race to the bottom where everything on social media will be tainted.
Yeah. Well, Scott Shane, national security reporter for The New York Times. We have a link to his story at onpointradio.org. Scott, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Meghna, for having me on.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.